Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here again. So I will talk about some work done in collaboration with Igor Rodnyansky. So this concerns the Einstein equation. So the Einstein equations, let me write them down in the simplest way, in the simplest case, which is that of vacuum, R alpha beta is equal to 0. So this refers to the Ricci curvature of a Lorentz metric G on a manifold M, which is 3 plus 1 dimensional. And the Lorentz metric G. And this is the Ricci curvature of G, right? So in other words, you take the Riemann curvature tensor and you take its trace, one trace, you get the Ricci curvature, and you set Ricci curvature equal to 0. This is exactly the Einstein equations in vacuum. And so the Einstein equations in vacuum are really, in some sense, the most interesting part, at least from a mathematical point of view, of the Einstein field equations, in which case you really also connect the space-time metric to another field, like fluid or Maxwell equations or so on and so forth. But this is already interesting enough mathematically. And in fact, I would say most new difficulties that have to do with the Einstein equations are already included here. Okay, so this is the situation. Now, let me make a few remarks. First of all, one has to interpret this equation in the sense of classes of equivalence of solutions, modulo gauge transformations. What that means is that if I give you a metric G, this is indistinguishable for phi star of G, or for pullback, phi star of G, where phi is any diffeomorphism from M to itself. Right? So physically, G is indistinguishable from Z. So really, you are talking about classes of equivalence of solutions. In other words, this of course reflects the covariance properties of the Einstein equations, and what it means practically is that somehow to solve the equations, I have to also specify in some way some kind of gauge condition, just like for the Young-Mills equations, for example. Once you make this observation, then the Einstein equations really become hyperbolic, they should be, and the simplest way to see that is to pick up coordinates. To pick up coordinates x alpha, so alpha here runs from one from 0, 1, 2, 3, such that the Dalembertian, so that means what I mean by this is the operator g mu nu d mu d nu applied to x alpha is equal to 0. Okay, so you are solving together with a system of coordinates. You look for the metric expressed relative to a system of coordinates relative to which this is satisfied. And then the Einstein equations take a form of a nonlinear wave system of wave equations, which looks like this, g mu nu, d mu, d mu of g alpha beta is equal to some nonlinear function of the metric and first derivative of the metric. So you could say n alpha beta if you want, the system, which is quadratic in the first derivative of the metric. Okay. Now, specifically, I'm not going to write down what specific n you get. It's quite complicated. Okay, but here you get an idea of what type of equations you get in studying this. So the equations are hyperbolic. It makes sense to talk about the initial value problem. So to initial value formulation for the Einstein equation is given in the following way. I'm not going to justify it here because I want to go fast to the main point of the lecture. But you are giving a three manifold together with a metric. Maybe I'll write it G bar together. Well, actually, let's do it this way. Let's write this bar here. Right. And then this one will be simpler G. So this is a Riemannian metric on sigma 3 and a symmetric 2 tensor K, which plays the role of second fundamental form. So you look at such a triplet, which satisfies the constraint equations. constraint equations. So the constraint equations are the equations induced by R alpha beta on a, so if I have a space-time and if I have a foliation by hypersurfaces sigma t, which are space-like hypersurfaces. So space-like simply means that the induced metric is Riemannian. The metric induced on the hypersurface is Riemannian. And then you see that this equation induced on the first and second fundamental form, right? So if I look at the first and second fundamental form of any one of the sigma t, there are certain equations which are induced by this, and they are called the constraint equations, and they look like this. There is Rij, sorry, maybe I'll write it like this. First of all, R minus K squared plus trace chi squared is equal to 0, and the divergence of K is equal to 0. Okay, so what that means is that the scalar curvature of this Riemannian metric, so this is a scalar curvature, satisfies this equation involving K and trace K. So all these things are easy to define. Let me not get into details because I won't need them. And so you have a scalar equation here, and this is a I should call it R bar, right? So everything here, right? Excuse me, R. R. So it's a scalar curvature of this. Okay. This one is bar, right? And this one, okay, bar. This is bar. This is bar. Okay. In any case, I'll get rid of these notations very fast. Just this is just for introduction. Okay. So what you do practical in practice when you solve the Einstein equations, you start up with an initial data set. That means a three manifold, a Riemannian metric, and a second fundamental form, which have to verify these constraint equations in order to have compatibility with the Einstein equations. And then I solve. In other words, to solve means to find some foliation of sigma t by some time function t in such a way that whatever I get will be a solution of this equation, and the induced first and second fundamental form are the ones given to you. Okay, so this is what it means to solve the initial value problem. Yes. This is called the wave coordinate condition. Harmonic would be in the case where you have a Riemannian metric, but this operator is a wave operator. It's not a Laplace. This one? Yeah, right. Right. It's the exact analog of the harmonic coordinate condition. Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. So you are solving, you are finding a solution of the equations together with a system of coordinates, in a big sky system of coordinates, so to speak. Right? So you find coordinates simultaneously. Okay. So this is the formulation. Now, what results we have? So there is a, insofar as the existence of solutions to the Einstein equations is concerned. So that means to solve the initial value problem or to solve the Cauchy problem, starting with this, there is an old result of Yvonne Choquet-Bruhat, in 1952, which gives you the following. So again, I'll state it rather roughly. If I have an initial data set, sigma jk, and if I know that g in a system of coordinates, in some system of coordinates, local system of coordinates, belongs into hs of sigma, and k belongs to, if you want, I can put a log here, k belongs to hs minus 1. Of sigma log, and if s is larger than 5/2, then there exists a unique solution of the Einstein equations, which is actually constructed by Yvonne Choquet-Bruhat exactly in this gauge, in this harmonic gauge. In for a short time. So there exists a local in time, And local in time means the usual thing, that you construct a solution in some interval. So, of course, you construct a time foliation and a solution which belongs in a time interval 0t belongs to, at every 6t, it belongs to hs, and the second fundamental form belongs to hs minus 1. So, in other words, you preserve the regularity of the initial conditions in hs spaces. Right? So this is the traditional result of local existence. And the result of Hibon-Choquet-Bruat simply says that somehow the Einstein equations can be formulated in such a way that the classical results on local existence for nonlinear hyperbolic quasi-linear systems can be applied. Okay? In fact, she used the results of Loret, the framework of Loret, in order to prove her result. Well, again, I mean, G bar is a space-time solution, so I'm looking at the induced metric on sigma and the second fundamental form, right? So you look at G, and roughly speaking, the time derivative of G bar is equal to K, okay? Right? So you look at the induced first and second fundamental form given by the space-time metric, right? Okay? Okay, now... Okay, so this result is, of course, uses a classical theory of hyperbolic systems, Sobolev inequality, energy estimates. And it's definitely not satisfactory from many, many points of view. Of course, it's a local result, and one wants to understand global results. And from a global point of view, one would like to get closer to the critical exponents, which can be formulated in connection with the initial value problem. What that means is that you observe that the G-bar metric, the space-time metric, can be rescaled, and you still get a solution of the Einstein equation. Right? So the rescaling is just G-bar lambda will be G-bar lambda t lambda x. And it's natural then to look for classes of initial conditions, which will have to be HS, because the HS, as it's known for hyperbolic equations, for hyperbolic systems, it's the only space which is preserved by the evolution, by the time evolution, whatever time evolution you have. So it has to be an HS space, and you are looking for the smallest values of S for which you can make sense of this local existence result. And traditionally, we believe that somehow this should be connected with that exponent, which is invariant under the scaling. Okay? In that case, you can easily see that the critical exponent, which is invariant under the scaling, is exactly 3/2. Okay? Of course, you have to take this 3/2 with a lot of some amount of skepticism, because these are the Einstein equations. They are quasi-linear. They are extremely complicated. And also, somehow, this notion here of scaling has to do with coordinates, as you see from here. If I have a scaling in some system of coordinates, if I change the system of coordinates, I have nothing. So it's not exactly clear what this means. But nevertheless, it's sort of a good place to start. And from our experience with other hyperbolic equations, which are less complicated than the Einstein equations, to be semi-linear, like Young-Mills or wave maps, you do expect to be able to go all the way to the critical exponent, in which case the local existence result will become global. So obviously, to get all the way to the critical exponent is going to be extremely complicated. In particular, you'll have to do a result which is much deeper than the result on stability, global stability of the Minkowski states, which we proved some 10, 15 years ago. So obviously, this is extremely difficult. And maybe not true, as I would try maybe to argue later on. In fact, it turns out that any exponent below this 5/2 is very difficult. The reason is because you have to give up on the classical techniques, which are based just on Sobolev inequalities and energy estimates. Sobolev inequalities are just simply not good enough. And again, we have the experience from semi-linear systems, where we know that if you want to go from if you want to go from a classical exponent, by the way, the classical exponent is always S critical plus 1 for all, actually, I should say maybe like this, S. So the classical exponent, in other words, whatever you can reach by classical methods, meaning Sobolev inequalities and energy estimates, in the semi-linear case, so for equations which are somewhat simpler than this, the classical exponent is always a critical plus 1. So you are always missing by 1. And if you want to go below this, you have to use other techniques like Strijhart inequalities. Strijhart inequalities or bilinear estimates. So these are sort of the two techniques that have been used very successfully for semilinear equations, to the point that, for example, in the case of wave map, so this is a hyperbolic system which has some geometric structure, I'm not going to get into it, and which in dimension, if I am exactly in dimension C plus 1, just like the Einstein equation, then the critical exponent for this wave map is also 3/2, and if I am in 2 plus 1 dimension, the critical exponent is exactly 1, and observe that 1 actually has to do with the energy, conservation of energy. So in this case, this is a critical problem, and if you can go all the way to the critical exponent, you are very, very close to proving global existence for large data, right? Which is sort of a very important result. And in this case, in the case of wave map, 1 can actually reach these exponents by using bilinear estimates and Strijhart inequalities, right? So somehow, these techniques, which have been developed in the last 10 years, based on Strijhart inequality and bilinear estimates, really went extremely far insofar as semilinear equations are concerned. To the point that I think it's very conceivable that now we are at the point where a global existence result for large data would be proved for wave maps, which would be quite a remarkable result. The belief is that Terry is going to do it. Okay. So that's the situation for semilinear equations. Now, for quasi-linear equations, you see the difference between semilinear and quasi-linear is that the linearized part of the equation in the semilinear case is just a standard Alan-Berchian in Minkowski space. Okay? So I'm talking about linear field theory in Minkowski space. And therefore, I can do Strijhart estimates and bilinear estimates relative to an object which is linear constant coefficient. I can use Fourier transform, right, in a big way, and of course that's exactly what's being done in order to use this, in order to prove such estimates. But in the quasi-linear case, since life is much more complicated because I have to deal with the Dalam-Berchian relative to a metric which is not even specified to me because I'm in a quasi-linear situation. So I'm talking about estimates involving low regularity, I expect that whenever I linearize around the background metric, this metric will have very little regularity, and I'll have to prove Strijhart estimates and bilinear estimates relative to such a metric, and that's, of course, a big, long story, and I'm not quite going to get into this, except in some... Quasi-linear means simply that the characteristics, the simplest way to define quasi-linear is the characteristic depend on the solution. Okay? Okay. Is it not further? Why? Well, you have two derivatives in the nonlinear terms. You see, you have g mu nu times d mu d nu g alpha beta. So you have nonlinearity at the highest order, in the highest order terms. I would definitely call it quasi-linear. I mean, once the characteristics depend on the solutions, I don't have fixed characteristics, I call it quasi-linear. But that's a next, if you want, you can split then quasi-linear equations into two types, one where the characteristics depend on the derivatives and the other one which doesn't, right? In fact, the two are very much connected because if I differentiate an equation of your type, I will get a system of equations of this type, right? So the two are intimately connected. Okay, in any case, I have now to deal with quasi-linear equations, and this is to do all these things is far more difficult. Okay, so I can tell you, however, what has been done. So there's been progress in the last few years, and in fact, using Strieker inequalities in this situation, which is much more complicated. So you have to actually prove a non-trivial Strieker inequality in backgrounds. So you linearize near a background, which itself will have very limited regularity. Anyway, using these sort of things, the best result. So the original result, there was some work. Maybe I should mention some. The whole modern theory of Strieker inequality on rough background started with Hart-Smith, followed by Bahuri and Chemin, who actually treated the quasi-linear case, and they were the first to actually derive results which were below this S critical plus one by gaining, in fact, one quarter. And then Tataru was able to improve a little bit. Actually, he was able to go, so let me write down explicitly what the exponents here are. So the critical exponent is 3/2. 5/2 is a classical exponent. Here, let's put 2. And Tataru was able to go all the way to 2 plus a 6. Okay, so this was the work of Tataru. Excuse me. Minus 2 plus 1 over 6. 2 plus 1 over 6. So it's a little more. So this is 1 quarter, gaining 1 quarter from 5/2. And here is, I'm measuring it slightly different, right? So here, I'm saying that you can go all the way to 2 plus a half. The result of Bahuri and Chemin would have been 2 plus a quarter. Right? Okay. Okay. So he improved a little bit. And Smith and Tataru actually also showed that using just linear theory, you cannot go below this 2 plus a 6. So they had a counterexample. And then Rodniansky and I, and I were able to go below this 2 plus 1 over 6. And then finally, in the case of the Einstein equations, we're able to show S larger than 2, strictly larger than 2, in other words, 2 plus epsilon. But we actually used, in order to get this result, we used the Einstein equations at some place. And there was another result of Smith-Tataru. Where they were also able to get S bigger than 2, but where they used, they didn't have to use the full strength of the Einstein equations. All you have to do is to look at quasi-linear systems very similar to the ones I have there in wave coordinates. Okay, right? Okay, so it's slightly, the result is slightly more general. Okay, so but what I want to talk about today is something else, which is the case S equal to 2. Okay, so S equal to 2. So S equal to 2 is particularly nice because 2 plus epsilon is not clear what you mean here, right? I mean, this is a strange, it's a very technical condition, but S equal to 2 corresponds exactly to initial data sets where the curvature, you see, if I take the curvature tensor of G, this belongs to L2, and the first derivative of K belongs to L2. Okay? So it's a very natural, exponent, and the conjecture, which is a bounded L2 curvature conjecture, is that indeed this suffices to prove local existence. Right? So this is still far away from the critical exponent, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. And as I will try to convince you, it might be that this is really the best result you can get. Okay, so this is a conjecture. And let me make some remarks. First of all, you see, the result mentioned above required S bigger than 2. Now, S bigger than 2 is known from experience with semi-linear equation, that this requires no structure on the nonlinearity. So you can take very general equations, for example, G alpha beta of phi. If you want, I put a bar. D alpha d beta of phi is equal to some nonlinear terms phi derivatives of phi. And in fact, the result of Smith and Tataru shows that if you have classes of equations like this, let me not be very specific. I mean, this, of course, has to be a Lorentz metric, which is smooth, right? And here it has to be quadratic in the first derivative, just like in the case of the wave maps, right? So this is a Lorentzian metric, depending on a phi, and phi is a solution, okay? So for this equation, as Smith and Tataru have proved, you don't need any structure of the nonlinearity to reach S bigger than 2. You can do it for general classes of equations of this type. However, to go from S larger than 2 to S equal to 2, that's just not going to be true. A general class of quasi-linear equations like this would simply not be compatible with S equal to 2. And there are some counterexamples due to Lindblad that shows that, indeed, if I take the examples of equations of this type, which would be ill-posed for S equal to 2. Okay. And again, we know from semi-linear equations, the same phenomena occurs to semi-linear equations, and it's known that in order to reach this exponent, for example, for wave maps, you really have to use bilinear estimates. So instead of Strichert, so this can be still done by Strichert estimates. Here, in order to do S equal to 2, you need bilinear estimates. So let me say a few words about bilinear estimates, at least in the semi-linear case. A typical bilinear estimate looks like this. I have Darambeshan of phi is equal to 0. Darambeshan of psi is equal to 0. Let me take the Minkowski space, 3 plus 1. So I'm in 2 by 1 dimensions. Again, for simplicity, the result is general. In fact, I'll give you the simplest possible bilinear estimate. And I'm looking at a bilinear form, qij of phi psi, which is di phi dj psi minus dj phi di psi. Okay, so it's a special combination of derivatives. It's a quadratic form in the first derivatives of phi psi. And I'm looking at q of phi psi, and I want to estimate this in L2 of spacetime. So L2 in the whole space, 3 plus 1. And the result is that this can be estimated by phi times 0, so the initial data. I'll write it schematically, the initial data. In fact, when I talk about initial data, I have to take both phi of 0 and dt phi of 0, right? And this I'm going to take in H2, and this will have to be taken in H1, but let me forget about it. Okay, I'll write it schematically. Phi of 0 in H2 and psi of 0 in H1. Okay, so this is a typical bilinear estimate. And the remark here is that, yes? Excuse me? Oh, this was proved by Macedon and myself in 1992 or something like that. 91 or 92. Okay. So the observation here is that if I take an arbitrary bilinear form, for example, if I take dt phi, dt psi, right, then this is false. This inequality is false. And the only thing that you can actually prove is whatever you prove by Strichert inequality, which will require some loss. Okay? You'll lose something here. Okay, so somehow there is a cancellation that takes place here. And of course, this cancellation here, this is the simplest Bailey estimate. It's what we call the first generation Bailey estimates. There are much more sophisticated ones where you take into account, you gain much more, but in order to make sense of that, you have to talk about HS delta spaces and so on and so forth. So I don't need to talk about it now, because this is more or less what I need to talk about in the context of this L2 curvature conjecture. Okay, so this is a situation here. And by the way, I should say, a typical result that was proved using these bilinear estimates was a global regularity result for Young Mills in 3 plus 1 dimensions, global regularity in H1, in the energy norm. So H1 corresponds to the energy norm. In fact, actually, the result is a local existence result in H1, but since the H1 norm is conserved for the Young-Mills equations, for reasons which I'm not going to talk about now, you actually get immediately global existence. So local becomes global. It's another paper, right? So this was a paper in the Annals. This is Communication in Pure and Applied Math. This was Annals, I think 94 or something like that, where we use these things in order to prove, we use these estimates in order to prove this result for the Young-Mills. Okay, now, in fact, this result is actually quite important from the point of view of the L2 curvature conjecture, because somehow the L2 curvature conjecture is sort of similar. Here also, the actual critical exponent for the Young-Mills equation in C plus 1 dimension would have been 1/2. And of course, the classical exponent is 3/2, and 2 and 1 is in between, exactly in the same way as 2 is in between there. And again, here, if you try to do it without using this bilinear estimate and without using the structure of the Young-Mills equation, so the Young-Mills equation, the structure of the Young-Mills equation is used into a specific gauge condition, actually in a Coulomb gauge, in order to explicitly show the presence of these bilinear estimates. All the nonlinear terms, all the tough nonlinear terms that you have to deal with can be organized in terms of null quadratic forms of this type. And then you use estimates like this. Okay? So that was sort of the main idea. And this exponent is global. If you don't use the structure, for example, if you just do Strickhouse inequality, you'll get H1 plus epsilon, which of course is not global because H1 plus epsilon is not conserved, right? Okay. Yes. Yes. Right. It's open. Going all the way to 1/2 is still open. So you can go to 1/2 plus a 6, I think. If I... Right. Right. But there is a major difference between the two, as I'll try to explain. Okay. So this is just to justify the interest in this. So let's see, how do you prove the... Rodniansky and I have now a program to prove this bounded L2 curvature conjecture for the Einstein equations, and that's what I want to talk to you about. So let me try to tell you what the program is. So the first part of the program is to write down the equation in such a way that once again the dangerous nonlinear terms are organized in terms of null quadratic forms. Okay? Right? So this is a quest for coordinates or gauge condition. Find a good gauge condition. Right? In other words, either coordinates or something else which are good and which allow you to apply this Bailey estimate. So, for example, wave coordinates are known to be bad. So we can easily find counterexample to show you that wave coordinates are just not going to be good. You are not going to get H2 in wave coordinates. The best you can get is H2 plus epsilon. So this is the first thing, find good gauge coordinate condition. So I don't want to talk about this part. This is work in progress. I think we know how to do it, but we haven't yet finished it. So all I can say is that this looks good. Two, so let me go to the second part. So the second part is now to estimate to find bilinear estimates, prove bilinear estimates. But of course now you have bilinear estimates where here, instead of being in Minkowski space, I'm on a space-time metric. Let's forget about the bus now. Whenever I write G, it's a space-time metric, right? So this now refers to a space-time. So I have a space-time metric, right? And I have a space-time metric here. I have a system of coordinates so that I can express this bilinear form. So the system of coordinates comes up from here, from the good gauge. So I assume that I'm already in a good gauge. The same space-time metric, right? The same space-time metric. And I want to prove an estimate of this type. Okay? However, it's clear that such estimates would be false if G is not a solution of the Einstein equation. So essential here is that G verifies the Einstein equations. In other words, R alpha beta is equal to zero. Okay? It's easy to find a counterexample if you don't take a solution of the Einstein equation. And I want this metric to be, I'm only interested in estimates which depend on just curvature in L2, right? So just depend on H2. So H2 estimates. So I'm not allowed to anything more than two derivatives of the metric G in L2, right? Okay. Obviously, this is what I need in order to close at the level of this L2 curvature conjecture, right? I'm trying to prove good bounds in L2, in two derivatives of the metric in L2, and of course the only thing that I can assume for consistency in a bootstrap argument is that I have good bounds for two derivatives of the metric in L2. Right? Okay, so that's proving bilinear estimates. So how do you prove bilinear estimates? Well, let me say a few words about this part. To prove bilinear estimates, well, you don't have Fourier transform anymore. Okay, so these were proved using space-time Fourier transform. Right. So we have a new proof. So here I'll mention the result, which is due again to Rodniansky and myself. We have a new proof of these estimates, which are based on plane waves. Decomposition. So actually, the proof is based on the following thing: you take the guy which you want to put in H2, so it's a low frequency. You can think of it as a low frequency guy, the low frequency phi, and you write it, you express it in terms of plane waves like this. It's e to the I lambda t plus x dot omega. And then lambda squared f hat of lambda omega, lambda squared d lambda d omega. So what I've done here is nothing else but the Fourier transform, the expression. So this is, of course, an integral from 0 to infinity, an integral on S2. Right? Omega is equal to 1, so I'm integrating on S2. And this is nothing else but e to the I t absolute value of psi plus x dot psi, the standard phase function that comes up when you write down, you express the solution of the wave equation in flat space, right, relative to Fourier transform. And then I decompose it into plane waves just like this, t plus x dot omega, and this is the approximation. Oh, sorry. Excuse me. Right. Thanks. So here I'm talking about Minkowski space. So I'm talking about a new proof of the bilinear estimate in Minkowski space, and then I'll say how you modify it. So the idea is to decompose a low frequency guy in like this and keep the psi, don't do anything about psi. Actually, keep it like this. And then it turns out, I don't want to go through the proof, it turns out that there's a very simple argument which allows you, when you look at Qij of phi psi, it allows you to decompose for fixed omega, to look at the derivatives of this phase function, combine with the derivative of psi, and do an L2 type estimate, so do a Cauchy-Schwarz estimate, where you take the part, the combination of omegas together with psi, which comes up here, and you take it on L2 norm of hypersurfaces, of the hypersurface, which is this one, T plus X dot omega equal constant. Okay, so this is a null hypersurface, as it's easy to see. It's a null hypersurface, and therefore the corresponding combination, so you get a combination of derivative of psi and the omega that comes up from here, is actually turns out to be a tangential derivative of psi along this null hypersurface, and therefore belongs to the flux. You can estimate it by flux. Okay, so it's a flux energy estimate. And the remaining part is something that involves Poincaré relative to F hat. I don't want to go through the proof. I just want to give you some idea that somehow this decomposition is very useful in order to treat bilinear expressions of this type. So there is a very simple proof like this. Now, what you want to do in the general case, what we want to do is to replace T plus X dot omega, to replace it by a function U omega of T and X. So this is now geometric optics. I'm doing the usual thing in geometric optics. I want to replace the phase function here. I want to replace by something which is now more complicated. So I'm still looking at an integral on S2. In other words, I'm looking at an approximate solution now, right? So I'm on a metric now, G. G is my metric. And I'm looking at an approximate solution for the equation D'Alembertian with respect to G of phi equal to 0. And I do it by writing, this is integral on S2, e to the I lambda u omega of t and x. And then there would be this f hat of lambda omega. I have to make sense of what I mean by this, but let me not get into it now. And of course, I have an integral from 0 to infinity, and then d lambda and d omega. And as you know, everybody knows here from geometric optics, if I apply the D'Alembertian to phi A, I get two types of terms inside the integral. I get a term lambda squared, but which comes up with g alpha beta d alpha of u omega, d beta of u omega. Okay. So you get a term like this, which comes up by differentiating twice the exponential. That's why you get the lambda squared. And then I get another term, which is a lambda times D'Alembertian with respect to g of u omega. Okay, so this is the term you get, and then here you have lambda squared f hat of lambda omega. Okay. And of course, this is a very bad term because it has a very high frequency here. You lose two derivatives. So what you do is that you take this to be zero, and that's nothing else but the Iconal equation. So this is the Iconal equation. In other words, you look for solutions of the Iconal equation. Instead of this, you look for a solution of the Iconal equation. Okay. And this part here, unfortunately, will have to become an error term. And of course, I cannot explicitly solve the wave equation anymore. In fact, the standard parametric construction for the wave equation involves taking transport equations, right? So it involves taking corrections of this principal term here. But then each time you make corrections, you lose more derivatives of the metric, so that's terrible. So you don't want to do that. So your only hope is that somehow once you took a solution of the Iconal equation, you can estimate this term. So the end result now is that to prove bilinear estimates for a curved background metric G, I need two things. First of all, I need a bilinear estimate for QIJ of phi A and psi. So this is the approximate solution. And psi, I keep it just like before. Okay. This we can do. So this is more or less the same argument as we did in flat space, with the observation that somehow whatever you need from solutions of the Iconal equation is very little. You don't need too much. The part which is far more complicated now becomes estimating the error terms. You have to estimate this integral from 0 to infinity, integral on S2, and then you have lambda, the version of g of u omega, and then you have lambda squared f hat of lambda omega d lambda d omega. And here, it's easy to see that the only thing you can do once you've made this approximation is to estimate this in LT1, LX2. This is a standard situation whenever you write down an approximate solution. So you need an estimate like this. Okay, so in other words, you need, you know, here you have two derivatives of u omega, and therefore you need to make sense of u omega. You need to control u omega. And this brings me now to part three, right? So this was part two. Let me write now part three. So part three is, in order to complete part two, you need very good control on the iconal equation. So control all solutions of the iconal equation. In rough, by rough, right, meaning curvature in L2, L2 curvature, in rough background, which are also solutions of the Einstein equation. Without it, nothing, you can't do anything here at this level. So let me try to explain this part. Okay, so this is a part that we have completed to our satisfaction in terms of what is needed for the program to do the whole thing. And also, it's a part which is interesting in its own right, so as I'll try to explain now. So this is actually sort of something that can be completely abstracted now and viewed by itself. I give you a solution of the Einstein equation. Okay, so I give you a background. So I guess I can erase this. Sure. Yes. Right. Oh, it's much better, right? Yeah. If this was not true, we'd be in trouble. Right. So this is what I'll try to explain. Right. So this is what, think of it in the following way. You have a space-time, which is solution of the Einstein equation. So it's an Einstein background. In other words, it satisfies r alpha beta equal to 0. Okay? And I'm trying to solve this equation, g alpha beta d alpha of u, d beta of u is equal to 0. Okay? And my metric is allowed to be only in H2, right? So whatever that means, of course I have to make it precise, right? But it should belong in H2. Okay, I'll make it precise in a second. So let's do sort of a very fast start. I mean, first of all, whenever you write down, imagine the following situation. Imagine that I am on sigma 3, I am on a C-manifold, I have a two-surface, right? And I'm trying to construct a solution of the iconal equation with initial conditions here, okay? So this, you know, the standard procedure is to look at the collection of null geodesics starting from this point. And I'm not going to look at the outgoing null geodesics. In other words, null geodesics, which as I go to, well, imagine that I have some notion of future orientability. So as I go to future time, the projection of this null geodesics from my sigma t point outside the domain, right? Outside this domain here. So imagine that I have the boundary of a domain. It's one of the sheets, right? There is another sheet which goes this way, right? There is an incoming sheet and an outgoing sheet. So let's look at the outgoing one, right, for simplicity. Well, it's the same thing, actually. Okay, so obviously I'm looking at null geodesic. First of all, do null geodesic make sense, right? I mean, as you all know, I have to look at an equation, right? The equation satisfied by geodesics. And they involve something like, they involve taking something like this, d2x over ds squared is gamma times dx over ds. I write it schematically, dx over ds, right? And that is very schematical, where gamma is a Christoffel symbol of the metric. So here you have first derivative of the metric. And now, to make sense of this, at least you should assume that this is Lipschitz, right? Which means two derivative of g should be near infinity, right? You can write it down as a first order equation, right? I mean, you just get rid of this, right? So you can write it as a first order equation. So you see immediately that you need at least this. And of course, curvature in L2 is far, very far from this, right? So a priori, it's not even clear that you have null geodesics. Okay. So the result, let me state the result which we proved. So I guess this I can erase. So nevertheless, the fact that you have a solution of the Einstein equation plays a major role. So this situation is sort of a generic situation. If I don't know anything more than just that gamma belongs to first derivative of gammas are in L2, there is nothing I can say about this. I mean, this is terrible. I don't have uniqueness. I don't have existence. I don't have anything. But if I have a solution of the Einstein equation, in fact, this is true. And therefore, the theorem that we prove goes like this. So once again, I start up with some initial data. And I look at this outgoing null cone. Imagine that you don't have a problem with the regularity of the metric. I mean, you can assume that you have a smooth solution of the Einstein equation. But I'm trying to look at the null hypersurface, and I look at the collection of null geodesics, outgoing null geodesics, starting from points on my surface. And also assume that you have some kind of conditions on the initial conditions. You can assume, again, whatever you want. The initial conditions, let's say, I don't care. Let's say initial conditions will be defined by some norm, which I call J0, which refers to the geometry of these two surfaces. Okay? So these two surfaces, the topology of a two sphere, which is, by the way, not exactly what's needed in this bilinear conjecture, because remember that what we had here were null planes rather than null hypersurface. I mean, rather than null cones. I mean, this looks more like a cone. But the difference is rather small, so it's not important. And I think this is, from a geometric point of view, more interesting. Okay, so I start up with a two surface like this. I look at my null hypersurface. Let's call it H, and let's define the affine parameter. S is affine parameter. So what is the affine parameter? It's a parameter which is defined by the equation L of S is equal to 1, where L is a null geodesic. So this is the null geodesic operator. It's a vector field, which is obtained by looking at the solution of the Eikonal equation. So I look at the solution of this, and I form essentially the gradient, right? The Lorentz gradient. Okay? And it's easy to see that L alpha is relative to the metric, to the space-time metric, is equal to 0. In other words, it's a null vector field. And DL of L is equal to 0. In other words, it's a null geodesic vector field. Okay? Okay, and I fix up this affine parameter. And with this affine parameter, I foliate my null hypersurface by surfaces which I'm going to call S little s, where little s is this affine parameter, right? So these are surfaces where S is constant, okay? And right, so now let me write here the Eikonal equation. How much time do I have? Okay. So this is a null, right? Okay, so now the assumption I'm going to make, the only assumption that I'm going to make, is that the curvature I'm going to make an assumption which is consistent with the fact that my metric here, right, so this metric satisfies the Einstein equation and has curvature in L2. So again, I have to make it precise, or I'll do it now. The curvature is in L2. So what I want to say is that the flux of the curvature on this non-hypersurface is bounded. This is the only assumption that I'm going to make. So what is the flux of curvature? So flux of curvature . So here's how you define the flux of curvature. You start up with the following fact about the Riemann curvature tensor. The Riemann curvature tensor, for any metric, so this is a general fact, it's not just Einstein equations, but any metric, satisfy this d epsilon r alpha beta gamma delta. You take the covariant derivative relative to the metric, and you take cyclic permutations over all indices, and this should be equal to zero. It turns out that if the Einstein equations are satisfied, you have another pair of equations, so this is zero. You can show that this is equivalent to the divergence of R alpha beta gamma delta is equal to zero. Right? So this makes this equation, if you look at these two, you can think of it as some kind of Maxwell system. Some Maxwell system. And you can associate to this a tensor, a full tensor, four-index tensor, Q alpha beta gamma delta, which I'm not going to make it precise, but it looks roughly like a curvature term times another curvature term plus a dual, Hodge dual, times Hodge dual. So it's sort of an energy momentum tensor similar to the one that you can write down for the Maxwell equation, except that because of the fact that this has four indices, this also has four indices. Turns out that it's symmetric relative to all indices. So this is sort of a beautiful fact about the Einstein equation, is that you can write down some expression like this, which has all the nice properties of an energy momentum tensor. It's fully symmetric. It's traceless relative to any two pair of indices. And, of course, it satisfies the divergence, Q alpha beta gamma delta equal to zero. Therefore, I can do energy estimates with this, very similar to what you can do with the wave equation or the Maxwell equation. So what I want to do is to do energy estimates, say, outside this non-hypersurface. So when I do that, again, I obviously don't have the time, but basically what you are going to get is some energy conservation. Of course, you don't have conservation anymore. You have some error terms. Let's forget about them for a moment. But in any case, you'll get that the energy here is equal to the energy at time t equals zero. So this is t equal to zero, plus the energy of the flux, right? So this plus this is bounded by this. And therefore, you have, in whenever you want to prove a bounded L2 curvature conjecture, it's natural to assume that you have a good control on the flux of the curvature along this. Flux of the curvature means exactly the flux which you get by energy estimate starting with this energy momentum tensor. Right? Okay. So you assume that the flux of the curvature is bounded. Okay, so flux of curvature is bounded on this now hypersurface edge. So this is the only assumption I'm going to make. And of course, I have to make some assumption, initial condition assumptions. So these are initial conditions here on S2. Okay. And now what I want to show is that the radius of injectivity, so this is a theorem, the radius of injectivity of H is bounded away is running from below, I should say, from below by this curvature, this flux of the curvature, let's call it. So let's call the flux of the curvature, right, let's call it like this, okay, by R. Okay. So what that means is that, to be more precise, what it means is that if I pick up S to be 1, so if I want to go up to 1 here, okay, so if I want to show that my null hypersurface is well-defined at 1, radius of injectivity simply means that there are no intersections, right, that this the problem that you can have is, of course, that two null geodesics will intersect instantaneously, right? So there is no null hypersurface so to speak of, because you'll have caustics immediately. So the theorem says that if I start up with time one, and if I start up with a good hypersurface here, a good hypersurface means that it's something which has, for example, radius of injectivity bounded away by 1, okay, bounded from below by 1. And if I assume that the flux of the curvature is sufficiently small, then I can show that the null hypersurface is well-defined up to time 1, okay? And unfortunately, I won't have any time to tell you what are the ideas of the proof, but maybe I'll just say one word. Okay, so, excuse me? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if the flux is sufficiently small, so if I'm on time one, if I want to go up to time one, I assume that the radius of injectivity of the original hypersurface is bounded away from below by one, okay? For example, if I take something which is close to 2 sphere, right? Then I can go to time one, provided that the flux is sufficiently small, okay? That's a result. And let me say a few words about the proof, because unfortunately I won't have time to. Right. Exactly. This will have to be applied to hypersurface. Instead of this null hypersurfaces like this, which have curvature, I'll have to apply to null planes, right? But it's essentially the same. Exactly. They could also, exactly, they could develop instantaneously, right? In other words, I would not have any time on which a good null hypersurface can be constructed. Right? Okay. So maybe it doesn't make any sense to talk about the proof, which is quite complicated, but in which there are some very simple ideas. But it will take me maybe too much. Maybe I just want to make a remark in connection with Riemannian geometry. So if you look at Riemannian geometry, so if you have a compact manifold, if you take a compact manifold and a metric G, one of the fundamental results proved about the radius of injectivity on compact manifolds, which plays a very, very important role in just about everything in differential geometry, including the work of Perelman, for example, is that the radius of injectivity can be bounded by, in terms, you found the bound from below of the radius of injectivity expressed purely in terms of the volume of M and the L infinity norm of the curvature. So curvature in L infinity. Right? Well, you see our result requires curvature in L2. Of course, in so this is a general result in any dimension. Right, exactly. Right. Well, our result requires only L2, but it's an Einstein metric, right? Right. But for example, in Riemannian geometry, there is no result like this, which tells you that if you have an Einstein manifold, you can do better with the radius of the geometry. Right. So, maybe. Right. But another remark I'll make, however, is that the result is sharp. So our result is sharp. Now, maybe I'm...
Well, this is...
I think they can. I think the refinement goes LPs. You can go with any LP in dimensions. Well, it depends on the dimension now and so on. But you can know there is no critical result. In other words, they don't go all the way to the critical exponent. Right? So for example, in the case of the. So what I understand, I'm not entirely sure that what I'm saying is right. But from what I was told by people, you will be able to go maybe to L2 plus epsilon in the same dimension. So it should be in the same dimension. The result they have will allow you to go to L2 plus epsilon maybe. But certainly not to L2. Right? And in fact, to go to L2, so that's what I want to say, that the result will be critical. Why do I say it will be critical? Obviously one will have to provide a counterexample to show that if you go below curvature in L2, you don't have the radius of the sphere cannot be bounded away. We don't have such a result, but we have plausibility results, right? So in fact, one plausibility result is that everything we are using is sharp, and you can see there is absolutely no room. So this is one, and it's also quite canonical. It's very hard to imagine that you could do anything else. So the estimates are very sharp and canonical. So I don't think you can do anything else. Another thing that you can do is to compare with Minkowski space. See, in the Minkowski space, in other words, if I assume that the curvature is zero, and I start up with a two surface which is not convex, right? Then I know that in finite time I will have a caustic forming. Okay, so the caustic is unavoidable. Also, I can write down exactly what are the quantities which will determine this blow-up. And it turns out that unfortunately, I didn't have the time to write this down. It's there is an invariant of the null hypersurface. So if I look at the null hypersurface, I can define an invariant, a scalar invariant of the null hypersurface, which is called trace chi. And this becomes minus infinity at the caustic. Right? In other words, if I don't have control, what this means is that if I don't control the infinity norm of trace chi, I have absolutely no chance of doing anything which avoids caustics. So the hope is to get trace chi in infinity, even in the curved spacetime. And in fact, that's exactly how we prove. So the result, if I have to make it more precise, will tell you that in a first, at least one of the statements would be that the trace of this now second fundamental form. Right, which depends on S, is bounded in L infinity on these two surfaces, okay, for every S. You can easily see that somehow whatever estimates we have, so we do prove this one. We prove that this is bounded in L infinity. But this is very easy to trace it down to curvature, and it's very easy to see that if you have anything less than curvature in L2 on the null hypersurface, this trace of chi will become infinite. And once it becomes infinity, that's another interesting thing. You can see here, again, from these examples, once it becomes infinity, you can see that all the LP norms break down. They all become infinite up to P equal 2. So you are not losing just an infinity. You are losing everything all at once. Right? And that's the reason why we believe that somehow not just the geometric result about the radius of injectivity, but also the full result is sharp, that in principle you will not be able to go below this one. But again, this we are less sure about. It may be that somehow one can prove bilinear estimates even when you don't have radius of injectivity under control. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that. All right. Sure, you can say all sorts of things like this, but you know, try to prove it. Right. But indeed, it is conceivable that somehow you don't have good geometry and yet some bilinear estimates can be proved. But we don't know anything about it. Right, I'll stop here.